read some statements that are being made about preaching. And I'd like you to guess. How many years ago these were said? These are articles in popular periodicals. Defects of preaching on the assumed popularity of evangelical preaching. Bad preaching. The declining influence of the pulpit in modern times. Here's one called Dull Sermons. Is the pulpit losing its power? Is the modern pulpit a failure? I like this article, The Dead Pulpit. And look at this one. I love this title, The Pulpit in the Good Old Days. Now, if you had guessed, how many years ago would you guess those were written? Beverly says 21st century. Do you know the most recent one of those was the last one, and it was The Pulpit in the Good Old Days? The most recent of those was 1899. I'm reading from a Clyde Pence book who collected these prognostications of the demise of preaching at just the time we look back now as the golden age of the English-speaking pulpit. Henry Perry Lydon, St. Paul Spurgeon, Joseph Parker, F.B. Meyer, Campbell Morgan. This is in the middle. Henry Ward Beecher. And here are these articles pronouncing DOA. Right in the middle of their preaching. One thing it reminds you of is that preaching is stubbornly here. In the presence of the church. And a deacon said one time, it's like Johnson grass, you just can't kill it. I want to prime the pump a little bit. We're going to have this as just an open dialogue about preaching, and I'm here as a respondent among other respondents. I said last night, it's a little bit awkward to be here in the middle of so many valued colleagues as someone who's standing up here as an expert on this. A lot of fine opinions on this faculty, but I'm the man on the spot. So if you would like to ask some questions generally about homiletics, content, preparation, delivery, the situation in homiletical theory, I'll be happy to try to interact with you. How do you prepare a sermon from a narrative passage? Well, that's a good question, because the major emphasis in preaching over the last 30 years has certainly been narrative preaching. If I had to use one word of my own, you're asking how I do it. Is that what you say? All I can do is talk about my own methodology. I don't care what style I'm going to try to preach. Inductive, deductive, narrative, something else among the styles. The first three things are the same. And that is a careful reading of the text in multiple translations, both committee and individual. A careful reading of the text in the original language. And the use of at least a half dozen analytical, critical, philological, recognized exegetical tools. I always want to come to the text as a blank tablet. We don't. We all bring a lens, and do the best I can. So that's going to be the preparation for any sermon. Nothing going to be preparation for anything. It's going to be just good, basic blocking and tackling. What's the big idea of this text, even in a narrative? What's the subject, and what's the content? Now, in a narrative sermon, I'm not going to get up and say that. But I'm going to have it in my head to give the sermon unity and mood. Now, if you ask what characterizes narrative of any kind, it's a story and a storyteller. It moves from cause to effect, and it moves through time. So as I think about the text, I want to think about those things. Here's a tale told by a teller. It's a story. It's going to move from cause to affect moves through time. For example, I think it's Ed Steinman, needn't thought somebody, I can't remember who it was, said in the book, no, it's more recent than that, but writing about this, Kellogg's text on narrative. It says, look, if you just make the statement, the king died and the queen died, that's not a narrative. See, if you say the king died of a heart attack and the queen died of grief, it becomes a narrative. Moves from cause to effect, moves through time. One thing I want to keep in mind, at least if not in front of mind, in back of mind in narrative, is what is the nature of narrative, and not trying to impose on narrative something that aborts the very nature of narrative. Second thing is this, I try to be very light-handed in putting in timeless aphorisms, or you might say conceptual statements. Now, if it's a deductive sermon, just good old basic beans and cornbread deductive preaching, it's going to be hung, every movement of it, on announced timeless statements. Sometimes we need life's whispering gallery because of brokenness. I'm not going to hide it. Narrative preaching, you don't want to be heavy-handed about. They may come in very lightly in the midst of a scene, a rhetorical package of movement, but not with a heavy hand, or you undo narrative, okay? Not heavy-handed aphorisms or timeless conceptions. Another thing I find helpful today, I don't do it very well, I like to do it better in narrative, is anachronistic narration, talking about past events as if they're going on right now, with images, tropes, comparisons from pop culture and so forth, imported back into the text. Now, that always scrambles a few people's brains who are absolutely literal in the congregation. You know. If you say Jehu got in his Ferrari and drove back to Jezreel, one person out of 500 is going to come up and say, I have no idea they had cars back then. And all you can do is say, bless your heart, send them home. For those who are not overly literally minded, they understand the trope, they understand the comparison, and it helps push the text out of wasness into isness. Now we go on and on and talk about that. Eugene Mallory wrote a little book called How to Preach a Parable. It's really about narrative preaching, in which he talks about four ways to do it, which is a good resource. The book that kicked off the whole present movement of narrative preaching in mainline Protestantism was a book in 1980 by Niedenthal, Rice, and Steinman on narrative preaching. It's been the source, the resource out of which dozens of other books have come. TV. In short, people are used to narrative episodic things. And I don't mean to be flippant, but that's not just my opinion. An evangelical like Haddon Robinson, a mainline like Tom. The people think narrative. And you say, of course, many people like linear thinking. Now, what happens to a linear thinker and a note taker when you're preaching a narrative sermon? They sit there waiting for the what? The point. And, you know, diehard note taker, particularly if they go to a fill in the blank church. They wait all day. So, you know, it I said, Cleo LaRue made a statement in his new book, brand new book by John Knox, I Believe I'll Testify, we're using it in the text, in the class. Cleo said, the problem is not with narrative preaching. He said, the problem is with boring narrative preaching. There's a lot of truth in that, but narrative's gotten a bad rap. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with it. It makes the note takers a lot happier if you're deductive, but deductive preaching has gotten a bad rap because of sometimes being boring and predictable. And we're coming, I think, in the Academy of Homiletics to a time, I've heard it discussed, that we may be coming after 30 years to the end of the great emphasis on narrative and wondering what's next. And that's not going to go away, but there is a sense in the air, what's next? For example, Tom Long has returned to what he calls Puritan plain style preaching. Just because he's doing that, he says it's what's next. Okay? Or indeed, you're not in a series. Sunday's coming. Yeah. Well, I try to stay away, by all means, of hand-to-mouth preaching, even as an itinerant preacher. I try to have a plan, and a plan to plan. I say that advisedly, not just plan, but plan to plan, because church life will run over you. I've found that my comfort in getting ready to preach is altogether related to how early in the week I start. And particularly, if you try to be, at some level, an exegete, you just really cannot sit down on Saturday afternoon with a half dozen analytical exegetical commentaries. It's like trying to eat a porterhouse steak in one swallow. You just can't do that. So I would say, first of all, plan. Be ahead of the game. Now, finding what the big idea of the text is I think, any preacher's struggle. It's facile to say that always just jumps out at you full grown. Many times, I have to labor over a text to ask, what is this text talking about? What's the subject and the content? What's it saying? What do you want to say about what it's saying? Which is the way communication takes place, subject and content. Many times, I'll be deep into the process of writing out until finally I get to that. It's a blessed day when it just jumps out and grabs me, so I know what this is about and what I'm going to say about it. If that happens too often, you may be reading into the text rather than reading out of it. Does that get at what you're asking? All right. F.B. Meyer is fading into the background now. Some people I quote, I don't know, I've read them all my life and they're disappearing. Meyer said the art of exposition is the art of elimination. If you're a studied, in any sense, expositor, and I don't mean dry as dust, historicized, and scholastic expositor, I mean by expositor, you're trying to communicate the Bible to people. You're going to have to leave stuff on the cutting room floor if you study. And the big thing is, what am I going to leave out for the studied preacher? I've estimated you'll have 3 to 5 times more stuff than you can say if you do exegetical work. You're going to have to leave 2/3 of it out. So the art of it becomes not what do I hold in, but what do I take out? And in that regard, you have to watch saying things in sermons that are a receding or regressive gain. Those of us who enjoy exegesis are always pushed to read one more thing, which if you're in the academy, you have to do exhaustively. You can't leave anybody out. But as a working weekly preacher, you can't do that. And if you start reading, you know, Dr. Pretzelbender's footnote for just one more rare insight into this text, as a working local church preacher, you get a regressive gain. And one way I leave stuff out, just getting ready to preach, not writing something you can't get ready to preach, is just stop. Have a time when you stop, research, and start writing. There's no terror like a blank page of paper. It's always easier to read something else than to say, how am I going to say it to these folks in front of me right now? And I have a practice of just letting the curtain fall on Wednesday. I'm getting ready to preach, and then I'm going to write something. And that helps me leave some stuff out. Preaching is a deductive art, like sculpture. You're chipping away at good stuff. It's subtractive. You've got to chip away at a lot of good stuff that falls on the floor to get to the image that you want. Well, thanks for asking, then. So some well-known, some not known. I think we're all affected by a choir of voices around us. It's my theory that whoever the home church preacher is you listen to, time creates something into you that never gets out of you. You know, I just think it. You know, Brother Ira Bendit, Connell Baptist, Fort Worth, 29 years. His voice is in my head. First time I ever heard passages. I don't think you ever get all of that out of your head. I had never really heard exposition, though, till I think I was, I don't know, a sophomore, junior at Baylor. I went up and heard a preacher in his 30s at that time, who was really trying to do studied biblical exposition, D.L. Lowney, who's now in his 70s. And I listened to somebody who was actually trying to preach what the text said. And that was something of an epiphany in me. He bent me in a certain way, and I could have gone on a very different way. If you're a certain age, a lot of folks told you to read what I would call the classic English language pulpiteers. And I'd have to say the biggest influence on me that bent a twig in direction were those names you, everybody in here, know. Alexander McLaren and G. Campbell Morton. And to a lesser degree, people like Parker and Meyer and Henry Perry Lydon. And not as many Americans, some Henry Ward Beecher. Henry Ward Beecher was so generous, I don't know how many people he influenced. He could just open his mouth and make it up. Yard mile, extemporaneously. So I think I still, those, and some regional preachers we could name that I just grew up hearing, you know. And they got into my head. Some of them had to try to get them out of my head. I could name some names. Wound up closer to some of them than I thought I'd be, but it's a part. I go back to what I said. I do think the first preaching you're exposed to at any length has a formative effect on that you never quite get away from. I don't think anybody's ever studied it, but I think so. You were talking about a high-tech drive, is that right? Yeah. Well, that leads in several directions, and one is how much do you use that in preaching? We talk around that endlessly. David Buckley, who retired at Vanderbilt, was a phenomenologist of language. He could be very acid sometimes. He said, Paul didn't say faith comes by hearing and hearing by PowerPoint. And what David was saying, in the case that he makes, for any generation, there is something primary about the auditory over the visual informing faith. And I think that's something worth thinking about, particularly when there's increasingly a split between the auditory and the visual in the preaching moment. But having said that, a distinguished guest we had here a year or two ago, Dr. Haddon Robbins, 81 years old, I asked him, what do you think about all these film clips? And I was kind of hoping this old patriarch of evangelical preaching would just step all over him. And he didn't. He said, I'll do anything short of sin to communicate. I said, well, thank you, Mr. Octogenarian. Made me feel like the old geezer in the crowd. When you talk about communicate, can I just say this? One thing I know as an itinerant and as a cross-cultural preacher facing all kinds of things. Whatever you do to communicate with other generations, you have to stay inside the habitation of your own personality. And I don't know what that means totally, but I do mean I cannot inauthentically step outside of me. No, it's no secret. I spent a lot of time preaching in African American churches. So I thought, you know, I thought I was connecting some, but I said, you know what I'm really going to do to connect? I'm going to memorize a bunch of rap lyrics. They looked at me like, have you lost your mind? You know, because they recognized that I had stepped outside the who-ness of who I am. And I don't mean better, worse, higher, or lower. It didn't fit inside the authenticity of who I am, because they figured I probably wasn't sitting around listening to rap. Well, I, in attempting to overreach communication, stepped outside of the boundaries of habitation. So one earmark to me is, I don't care if it's multi-generational or cross-cultural. If I get outside the meanness of who I am, or the ironness of who I am, I think it stops communication. Authenticity inside the habitation of your own humanity does reach more than one generation. Now, you may not reach it as well as somebody else, but when I start trying to act like somebody I'm not, to reach out, you know, and I've tried stuff. I was in one of these, you know, I call them the torn up blue jean t-shirt churches. So I thought, well, you know, I need to try that. Maybe there's something to it. I didn't any more step out there, and I felt like the biggest fool in God's creation. You know, no one knew I was. And I think you have to decide in regard, can you sound your own tone of authenticity? And then try to use a few tropes or analogies or something out of contemporary culture that doesn't make it sound like you came out of Noah's Ark or something. But not beyond who you are.